secrets, and there is a common thread. Whether I'm talking to you or an astronaut or a business leader or a musician, there is a common thread of how you guys succeed basically in life and how you take on adversities.
Well, you know, similar, I mean, we've worked on similar projects. You know, my eighth book, my last three books are all in this same vein. I've written books about me dealing with and surviving what most people don't know is a deadly illness, but consider a chronic illness, being MS. Mm-hmm. And you know, my last two books, Living Well with Montel and Living Well Emotionally, I kind of cover those beats so that anybody, because there are things that everybody can do to have the same level of success. It's just a matter of putting your mind and working at it and saying you can and being proactive rather than being reactive. So, yeah, ready to go.
And the thing is, most people, as you know the right thing to do. Listen, a guy wants to go lose 25 pounds. He knows he's not supposed to eat the cookies and the cake and ice cream.
Correct.
So what I'm trying to do is to kind of get into your head a little bit and say, okay, you know the right. And I have about 10 questions I want to ask you, which I ask other people as well, too. And then what it's supposed to do, it's supposed to take whether it's a kid or a middle-aged guy and have them read about you. Hey, here's a guy, listen, he was African-American. You know, the odds were against him. The odds were against me. Got MS. Whatever it may be that, okay, he did it. See, the problem is a lot of people see you as a superstar. Well, he had it easy. You know, he's on TV. I can never be that. So the idea is to talk about the things that you've overcome, the strategy that you use, and then the whole thing is that it's supposed to provide the power to empower. To have somebody read this. So That's kind of it. And I just felt like it was kind of my way of giving back because I've been very fortunate. And we're interviewing 200 people, very well-known, good people. And
and, you know, look, as long as when you – how long will it be before you publish this? Because, you know, I am one of – I'm the new voice of Air America. I'm on every day, 9 to 12 daily.
Right.
I do a Living Well segment on the show every single day where I bring on people to talk about exactly this.
Oh,
so
okay.
When you're ready to do it or if you need more guests at any point in time, just give me a ring and I can put you on the air and we can talk about this project. We can talk about it even right now while you're working on it.
So. Yeah, no, it's great. It's supposed to launch. My goal is 200 interviews. I got about 110 right now.
Okay.
And good ones. I mean, you know, good ones. And obviously I consider, you know, you top of the food chain. But I appreciate it. What's the best way to contact you?
You know, the best way is to grab Christine because she knows I travel an inordinate amount and I'm on the road almost an inordinate amount. Meaning,
right.
Like right now, I mean, I literally I'll be flying out tomorrow. I'm headed to Las Vegas. I'm doing a, you know, charity poker tournament. I'll be back in New York like the next day. I'm in L.A. for 4 days. So
yeah.
If you just grab Christine, call her, tell my fellow, holler at me, and I'll call you.
That sounds good. Okay, let's get started. Okay, I'm going to put you on speaker so I can write while I do this.
Sure.
Okay.
See, I got to tell you, one of the things that's a little bit different about me, and, you know, I hate to say it this way, but I wrote about it in one of my verses.
Yeah.
I'm the product of a time in America where, you know, success for people like myself was literally absurd and unheard of. You know, right now America's enthralled with our current president, but there was a time that people forgot that, you know, racism was systemic and part of America. Division was systemic. We had, you know, apartheid in America, and I'm a product of busing. So for me, as I look back at my life and recognize why I am where I am today, I know mine came from what was a negative motivation that I turned into a positive, and I'll tell you what it was. You know, I'm a product of busing. I have two parents who are really inordinately powerful people in my life, have always been. My father, Jamaican, worked multiple jobs. My mother worked multiple jobs. We got an opportunity to move out of Baltimore City to a small suburb of Baltimore and then be bused to school to all white neighborhoods. Now, I went to school started off in school kindergarten, first grade in the ghetto of Baltimore, Cherry Hill. And then in the, you know, beginning of the school year, first grade, middle of the school year, first grade, moved to what's called Glen Burnie. And, you know, I'm the fourth child, the youngest of four, and my parents had a very strict edict in our home. You know, education was the most important thing in the world. And so from the time I can remember as a child, because my siblings were older, my father had a requirement that you come to the dinner table having read four words in the dictionary. You could use them. sentence, conjugate them, and give the exact Webster's Dictionary definition. So as a very small child, I, before I even went to school, developed a vocabulary that was really far superior to my years because I sat at the same table and would have to, even though my father knew I couldn't read, but would expect me to know something, and my siblings would give me words to say. So when I entered school with an ability to write long before my years. I also was able to draw. So as a very young child, African-American child, and in all-white school, I was a kid who wrote stories in the first and second grade that got read on the local radio. And this was done multiple times. I had about five stories that I'd written, read on the local radio. And
now, how did your dad come up? I mean, you know, today's age, white, black, or purple, I mean, I think that's unbelievable. How did your father come to the conclusion that that was a priority?
Well, for him, it was a priority. My father was the kind of person who literally, my father went to school for, 17 years to get his bachelor's degree. And my father went on in his life, held three cabinet posts in the city of Baltimore. He was the commissioner of transportation, the commissioner of public works. He was also the chief of the fire department in Baltimore City. Had a wonderful, elaborate career, but he went to school for 17 years at night. So, and I think for him as a child, he very quickly understood this. In his early year, he went into the fire department. My father had three or four jobs. He was a musician. He was a carpenter. He was self-taught and educated, but in the fire department, which required you for any advancement, you had to study. So for him, he had to do some catch-up, get his associate's degree. Then he went to school for 17 years to get his bachelor's degree. We grew up in a home where education was a key. And, you know, at a time in America where, you know, there was so much civil strife, you know, I think a lot of people back then understood that the only equalizer in their country would have been education. So it was very important to him. But as I went to school, there was immediate animosity and jealousy and sometimes anger on the part of teachers. Back then, you know, you stayed in one class the whole time. You didn't move around to different classes. But for this writing project, I had one teacher who literally was angered seemed angry. I didn't know this as a child myself at the time, but seemed angry when my story would be read on the radio rather than someone else's. And you know, after two of the stories being read that way, I had written one that I was going to submit for the radio station for a Christmas story. And that story, I'll tell you what it was. You might want to write a little bit of this. But the story was about me going to the store to buy Christmas presents with very little bit of money. Ran out of money, but I had enough presents. I couldn't get the presents wrapped. So I went down and asked the lady in the gift wrapping shop if she would wrap these gifts for me. If I cleaned up the floor, would she wrap the gifts? She said yes. I cleaned the floor, cleaned the whole place. She wrapped my gifts. I took them home, put them under the tree. Merry Christmas, happy good time. Wonderful story for a second grader, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I spelled one word wrong in that story.
Mm.
What word do you think I spelled wrong in that story? I told it to you. The word I spelled wrong was wrapped. I spelled it R-A-P-E-D.
Mm.
That teacher circled every one of those wrong spelled wraps and put a big red F on my page. Now, what I forgot to tell you is my father was also a type of parent who believed very strongly in spare the rod, spoil the child. And so, you know, I knew that there was a definite beating coming for that F. So I hid that paper I took it home, hid it in between my mattress and my bed. I didn't want to have my parents to see it. I didn't know what was wrong. The lady didn't even explain it. So the next day I went in and asked the teacher, I don't understand what I did wrong. And she looked me in the face and she said, that's why you people will never be anything in life, because you only have one thing on your mind.
Wow.
I'm a second grader. I had no idea what she was talking about. I hid that story for 3 years until, you know, in elementary school in fifth grade, they start teaching you how to use the dictionary. And you start really understanding it and understanding what those words meant. I looked up that word, R-A-P-E-D, and realized that this woman had made a decision about me this early in my life, and I couldn't take it. So that also made me understand that from this point forth, I'm going to be the only person that ever owns the definition of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what set me on my path for the rest of my life. You talked about the fact that when you were younger, you did very well in sports. I did well in sports, but I also did well in everything in school, as a matter of fact. I literally was elected to class president 2 years in a row, junior and senior year. I was a student on the Board of Education, elected to the Board of Education in my county. I was the Chesapeake Regional Association of Student Councils parliamentarian. I was the vice president of the Regional Association of Student Councils. I played in a band. I worked. I was a little bit of a community organizer, all at ages 15, 16, and 17. So this put me on a path in my life of refusing to let anybody ever tell me or hold me back or define who I was. And that's really the path that I've been on. I mean, I basically lived, I think, for the first part of my life before I started going to counseling about 10 years ago, I understood that I literally was living a life to prove one person wrong, which is really kind of crazy because what it did do is inspire me. That's not what our intention was, but it inspired me to make sure. And this is one of the things that I talk about. I mean, I teach, I speak on around the country. You alone have to own the definition of who you are. If you don't do that, there's nothing else and no way possible in your life you can be successful. If I had lived down to that woman's expectations to be a rapist or something else that she defined as a black man, I would be in jail like the rest of the kids that were born in the neighborhood, or dead or in jail like the rest of the kids my age born in my neighborhood, Cherry Hill, when I was born. It's really pathetic because we too often live down to other people's criticisms rather than forge what we own and believe in ourselves. And that's what we should live up to, and that's what I try to do from the time I was in the second grade on. I've been an overachiever my whole life. I went in the military. I don't know if you know this. I had 22 years in the military.
Yeah, no, I know your bio. Listen, I know your story. I grew up watching your – I'm 49.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up, you know, watching you on TV. Just tremendous respect. I remember when you were diagnosed. I mean, you know, I'm telling you, 20 years I've been looking and watching and seeing you and having just a tremendous respect for you.
No. Thank you. But it's crazy because, you know, when I look back at it sometimes, it makes me sad because I think there were times in my life that I, you know, missed out on some things of stopping and smelling the roses because I live a life where I have to constantly be achieving. Like right this minute, as we're talking, I have about nine different companies. I'm the brand new voice of Air America. I ran a new project that even got written up in the New York Times business section. I'm running a project right now with a partnership with a company called TriStar Products, which is a new innovative way to do infomercials that we've now proven a paradigm for, so much so that now I'm the keynote speaker at this year's national convention for all direct response television. I just started this project less than a year ago. I've written created a sitcom that I'm in the process of producing with the number one producer at all of television is Phil Gurn.
Now, do you think you do too much?
Sometimes I think I do, but sometimes I don't think, if I'm not doing this much, I feel like I'm wasting time, I'm marking time.
Almost kind of what makes you, breaks you in a way, though.
Almost, you know what I mean? And you know, I'm hoping that, and if I believe in what I really, truly think I believe in, and that is that in about 4 or 5 years, I will feel that I have accomplished what I need to accomplish, and now I can focus more, because I also don't even feel like I've given back enough, and it's time to do more giving back, and so...
But you don't really realize the impact that you've had on not just African-Americans, but I think anybody in general knows your story. I mean, listen, you got a tremendous amount of integrity, and so, you know, you've given more back than most, and you don't even realize that.
See, that's part of, like you just said, you know, what is my victory in some ways is my bane. I wish, and I really, really do mean this, I wish that sometimes I'd sat back and smelled the roses, just sniffed them once or twice, because things are flying by. And even like right now, I'm in the process of doing some things. It's almost insane. I was talking to my business manager, whose name is Melanie McLaughlin, and, you know, I feel so bad for her because I would wish that I could come up with a couple of ideas from time to time that were stupid or things that couldn't possibly work. But unfortunately, I keep coming up with all these ideas that
work. And, you're a creative person. You have a tremendous amount of experience, and you see opportunity. And somebody such as yourself doesn't want opportunity to pass them by for yourself or for others. So that's a positive thing. But it also prevents you from smelling the roses. If there is a balance.
Absolutely.
You know? You know what's interesting, and again, I hope you have some time because we're taking our time a little bit over here, but you had said, and again, this gets back to people know what they have to do, but a quote, you know, you have to be really the person who defines who you are. I think a lot of people know that. But what is really, what do you consider the top three things to really get to know yourself and to say, okay, this is who I am, this is what my values are, this is what I want to accomplish. What are the three things that they could really kind of, you know, how do you get to that point? What advice do you give to these people to get there?
You know, I fortunately got to spend time in the military, and in the military, I'm one of these guys who, you know, I did every platform the U.S. Navy has, pretty much. You know, I spent a lot of time deployed at sea and spent time about 300 days submerged above, below the ocean on submarines across the country. And you know, that gave me some time to sit back and literally do exactly what you just did to me, and that's ask some really hard questions of myself. I am a constant believer in self-evaluation. And I think that that's one of the starting places that people can build the self-esteem that they need, because when you start looking at how you really feel about things or things that happen, you know, hey, this will sound insane, but I've done it on a couple of occasions in my life, especially when those periods of time when it's tough, when, you know, the rubber meets the road. I will sit down, lay down before I go to bed. First off, I ask this one question myself every day. What did I do today that's worth talking about tomorrow? When I get up in the morning, every single day, this is my mantra. I'm telling you, I've been pleading with people to attempt to do this. When I get up in the morning, I used to write it down, and I tell people, if you want to try to do this, write it down. Write down that question. What did I do today that's worth talking about tomorrow? Before you go to sleep at night, after you cut that television off, after you stop all the silly conversations that you've been having or phone calls or emails, in the quiet of your room before you cut that light out, write down three things that you think you did today that's worth talking about tomorrow. Three things that happened today that are worth talking about tomorrow. Three unbelievably good things that happened today that are worth talking about tomorrow. When you wake up in the morning, when you go in that bathroom and pick up your toothbrush and you get ready to brush your teeth and you're looking in the mirror, look at those three things and start your day off with three successful things. Now, I'm telling you, I do this every day, but part of what I also did is I took the time along the way to sit down and actually try to think back as far as I can in my life to anything that pops up that I thought was important, and now let's look at how I actually dealt with that situation and look how I treated people. You'll start to find out that if you start doing little things like that, you do an exercise once a day of looking back in time, you'll start to look at yourself and what you do on a daily basis and start to question, not question, but actually review your interactions during the day. When you got up this morning and you walked out the door and that person looked you in the face and looked like they wanted to say hello but didn't know you and were afraid, did you say hello to them first? Mm-hmm. What did you do when you walked into the restaurant this morning and you went to get your Starbucks coffee and you noticed that the woman in front of you was being extremely nasty to that woman who was serving you that cup of coffee? Did you even stop for a second to think about how her behavior affected you, how it affected the person in front of you, behind you? These are things that I do. I do all day long. I'm looking for opportunities to figure out ways that I can know that if a certain situation happens again, how could I react and what are some other alternatives to the way I reacted? I'm constantly doing that, constantly doing self-evaluation, because as I do that, that's what helps me get to know who I am. And it starts to help me understand how I feel about things. Like right now, this current debate that's going on in America today about healthcare, people are running down the street corners to conference halls and jumping up and down and screaming at the top of their lungs things that they know that in their heart they don't believe. But they're just following lemmings because they haven't taken the time to understand what they believe.
Correct.
If you ask the normal person out here across this country today, what do you think about healthcare? They go off on a myriad of tangential issues that have nothing to do with the issue at hand and nothing to do with the information that's already been published and things and ways that we're actually looking at trying to deal with healthcare. Nobody's even talking about the true issue.
Right.
Because most people don't know how they feel. They don't even know how they feel about their fellow man. They don't even know if they feel good about the fact that we want to do something that might possibly help someone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's that's the one thing that I think for me is what keeps me going every day. That's why when I look at business opportunities, I look at them critically and I take them apart, put them back together. I don't just think about it from the greedy standpoint of, am I going to make money? But I also think about it, is this any good for anyone other than me? And what good will it do for the bigger picture? And I'm in the process right now of providing, you know, both my last three books were all about trying to get people to understand that you can impact your health how you doing? And most people, you know, we're so busy, used to the roadway we you know, trivialize our concern for others. When a person walks in the door, you say, hey, how you been, Bob? And turn around and look the other way, because we don't give a damn how Bob's been. We don't want Bob to give us the answer. If Bob sits there and goes, oh, my God, yesterday my child just got run over by a car. Oh, no, we don't want to know that. So why do we ask the question? Well, guess what? We do the same things to ourselves.
Here's what we do to ourselves, and one thing that I've learned. Let me ask you this question, and I'll tell you what I've learned from it and how a lot of people who would take your advice, believe it or not, would actually get hurt by it in a certain way, and let me tell you why.
Okay.
Why? What do you think? In your opinion, what do you think holds people back from reaching their goals?
The thought that they can't be successful. But part of what I was saying about reaching back and looking back and evaluating yourself, you're going to find out along the way you did so many more things right.
But they don't see it. The problem that I see in the trend and the common thread that I see in human nature itself is there's very low self-esteem. They give you 10 reasons why they can't accomplish something. So their worst critic is usually themselves.
But see, if you flip the paradigm and you get them to look back a little bit in their time, and as you explain what it is, I'm telling people, when they look back in their life, I'm looking back not to be critical of myself and say that I did this wrong or did that wrong. I just want to look at the situation. And you may find out along the way that along the way you did a lot of things right. Well, guess what? For the person who says, oh, woe is me, I can't, you know, that's normally, let's say, the person between their 25 and 35. I can't. But let's go back and say, wait a minute. You graduated from high school, right? You graduated with what, a 75% average? Okay, it wasn't 100, but who cares? 75% was passing. You passed. You accomplished. That's an accomplishment. Check that off in the plus block. You went to college. Okay, it took you 5 years. I don't care. You still finished. That's in the plus block. So as you're looking back at yourself, part of that evaluation is to say that I'm much more successful in things than I ever thought I was. I don't know. For me, it works. And, you know, I've kind of tried my best to try to convince other people to stop for a second and look at the good at themselves, that old silly saying, the glass is half,
yep,
you're half full. It can be always full.
The issue, I think, that people have is they look at it and they say, not me. And what happens is they give too much credit to certain mistakes as opposed to looking at it and saying, you know what, okay, I made a mistake, but I learned from it. I'm a better person for it, and I'm a smarter person. It won't happen again, and focus on the positive.
Well, just what you just said, if you add that to the entire theory and say that that's what we think, that if you were to use that as a tool and actually try your best to take a look back, you have to look at yourself, because you're not going to understand how you feel about health care, affirmative action, equal rights in marriage. You won't have the slightest idea where even some of your opinions have come from until you stop and you look back. Well, where did most people's opinions come from on the issue? Not that I'm going to take this one apart, but on the gay issue, where did most people's opinions come from? They don't come normally from personal experience.
Your parents
or something you heard when you were in school.
Right.
Well, you know, it's time to stop for a second. We're not lemmings. We're not animals. We don't run off a cliff because other people run off a cliff. Make your own assessment. And when you stop and you make your own assessment, you realize that, hey, you know, I spent time in the military. And believe me, back when I was in the military, I'm a Marine. I went to Parris Island in 1974, you know, back before there was a congressional investigation on abuse of troops in boot camps. And, you know, I'm sorry, back then, you know, it was a locked, conservative, right-wing, as far as it could be, attitude. You know, gays and lesbians, are you kidding me? And I walked around just like I saluted, you know, I was espousing the same garbage because somebody else above me espoused it, until I finally realized, after working side-by-side for somebody that I respected beyond belief, because they got their job done, they were always perfectly meticulous, and they were in the military, and they were gay.
Yep.
Who knew? I didn't know.
Well, because that's how your parents or the general public's parents, they came from that generation. And people, again, if you know yourself and you're saying, hey, get to know yourself, you're going to create these values for yourself, and you're going to say, you know what, two guys want to be married, they're not hurting anybody, let them be married.
There you go. But what you did is you understood why you formed that first negative response, and now you can put together whatever the response is that you feel you should have.
And I find it, fortunately, whether it was just something that was born I find it very easy to be positive, to look at the positive, to understand what my goals are, to write down my goals and to accomplish my goals. And that's really what this project is about, to help. Because you look at things like, well, what's the problem? You want something, take that first step forward. A lot of people struggle with that.
Yeah, and I guess what it is going back to that whole idea of owning the definition of far. It's not just for mantra's sake, but when you can get your brain to shift in that direction, and this doesn't happen overnight. You know, you won't gain that confidence overnight. You have to legitimize in your own brain, yes, I have accomplished some things. Okay, I'm buying into this. Okay, I buy into the fact that I did do some things right along the way. Okay, Montel, you might be right, but I'm not strong enough to walk out that door and walk into that office and say, you know, you need to hire me because I'm better than everybody. That's not what you do. You're going to walk into that office. You're going to first take a couple more baby steps, and those baby steps include, you know, setting about for yourself, knowing that knowledge is power, infinite power.
Where it pays off with your philosophy as well, too, is, you know, every day good things happen. You don't even completely necessarily need your philosophy. When you need it and when it pays off is when there's negativity, when you have a slight setback. Instead of it knocking you off the horse, you're going to say, okay, I knew who I am. I know I'm going to have certain mistakes and certain setbacks. I know that there's going to be negativity out there and people tell me I can't accomplish. But if they can understand better to what you're saying, knowing who you are, understanding who you are, it's almost like a shield that will continue to propel you forward. That's what I'm getting.
Absolutely.
Okay, biggest hardship, in your opinion, again, biggest hardship that you've overcome, and then how do you, when there are adversities, because nobody ever wins at everything, listen, you have medical issues, obviously, biggest hardship, what you concern, and then your advice on how to overcome everyday adversity.
Going back to that idea again, I the idea of who owns the best friend show you are, before I graduated from the Naval Academy in Annapolis, was really now looking in hindsight, most doctors think that was probably, I had my first episode with MS, but it went completely undiagnosed, incorrectly diagnosed. I was at the Naval Academy getting ready to graduate, getting ready to, you have to go through what's called your pre-commissioning immunizations. I went down, it's record that the first 100 guys through our line in our class that went down to get the diphtheria and typhoid shot, we got an overdose. No ifs, ands, or buts. The gun was set too high. It sent about 11 of us to the hospital. I was one of those 11. This is after putting in 4 years, 6 years at this point in time in the military, busting my butt to get a commission. What happened to me was I went into, literally, I ended up with like a 103-degree temperature. I was in the hospital for 5 days. I almost went blind in my left eye. And that vision stayed away for about 7 months. I had never really completely recovered. I was getting ready to graduate that June week in 2 months and got put on a military hold, a medical hold. As a matter of fact, and in that medical hold, I had the military telling me that I could have probably gotten anywhere from 70 to 90% disability because I was blind in one eye. And they were going to give me the disability, and, you know, I may as well just go ahead and check out and take that. And I was like, no, I'm not. I can't do this. I truly, for myself, you know, the toughest part was recognizing, again, that I knew I had something to offer. I knew that, you know, hopefully this is going to, either my vision comes back, but, you know, the Navy's trained me, the military's trained me now for 6 years. You can't throw me away. And I fought this all the way up through the Senate to get a commission to serve this country. And fortunately, I got it. I had Senator Mathias back and Barbara Mikulski were very instrumental in forcing the military to go ahead and commission me. And that really was one of the biggest turning points of my life. Because I think, you know, I had worked so hard to try my best to achieve and achieve and achieve, and this was, you know, for me, being able to toss that hat in the air was that symbol of achievement, and it was taken away from me, and I fought to get it back. And so I guess, you know, what was the main reason is because I, again, even at that point in time in my life, knew I was going to own the definition of who I am. I did, and I forced it. I guess, you know, if there was anything equal to that, that would have been the day that you know, the doctors looked me in the face and told me I had MS and I should just, you know, go home and basically wait to die.
So in other words, when you have adversity, how do you take
it? The knowledge. I mean, I immediately go directly to knowledge. I got to find out everything about the situation that is causing the adversity to me. When I was diagnosed with MS, I went on a mission to find out everything I could find out about MS, traveling the world to do so. I've met with doctors all over this planet because I wanted to I didn't want to be smarter than the doctor who I was seeing, but I wanted to know as much as the doctor who I was seeing because I don't give doctors credit as being God.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately set about knowledge, and then you know, knowledge is king in a sense. You get the knowledge that can help you deal with the situation. That's all I needed for MS. I needed to be able to tell those people above me that no, that I don't have to stop working right now. I'm very much qualified. I know exactly what I'm doing. I had to set about trying to figure out ways that I could mitigate some of my symptoms. I started working on that through diet and exercise, and have really now become one of the nation's authorities, not authorities, but well-asked experts on the issue of wellness, health, exercise, and nutrition, how it impacts chronic disease, and how you can reach for things and look for foods and things that can lessen, everything from inflammation in your body to, even see if you can, boost, other hormones in your body. So I'm working very, very, very difficult, but it's all about knowledge.
Right. Now, when you, and again, you may not face this like other people, but again, a lot of people know the right thing to do, right? But for whatever reason, they don't do it. Now, when you feel where you don't feel like doing something, you got to go up, you got to go talk to me, you got to go and run to a meeting. Whatever it is, a lot of people, they just blow it off or they just don't do what it takes. Again, a lot of people know if they want to go lose weight or go do something, they know the right thing to do. What separates you? How do you make sure that when you don't feel like doing something that you still get it done?
The glory in my life is the accomplishment. So, again, if I go to bed last night and I say to myself, what did I do today that's worth talking about tomorrow? I normally look for accomplishments. And those accomplishments may be as simple as having opened the door for the lady who, had a lot of attitude, walking out of Starbucks this morning, and I could have let her struggle with it. Of course I opened the door. She didn't say thank you, didn't say hello. It's okay. It didn't matter. I still helped her. But as I do these things and I accomplish things, that's what makes me understand that no matter what, I can accomplish things. And that's the piece. I mean, that's where you start to know. I don't look at something and go, I probably can't do that. I look at that and say, tell me why I can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Some people say why. I say why not.
Yeah, I mean, it truly is. It's the real deal. I it's really funny because, again, my manager, his name is Melanie McLaughlin, I and her were having a conversation a couple weeks ago, and I said, I wish somebody could prove to me the word no. Prove it to me. Prove no to me. I want you to do that because you know what? I've yet to have somebody actually prove no. Because when you tell me no, I'm going to figure out why your no is incorrect or why your why not is incorrect. And I'm going to push this in a way that I know that by the time we're done, I'm going to figure out how you're going to tell me yes.
Well, that's kind of a lot of what you did that I got from your talk show.
Mm-hmm.
You were very convincing to get your point of view out by still respecting the people and the guests, but you really laid it out very nicely. So,
thank you.
But I guess I'm dating myself. Let me just see over here. Do you have a favorite motivational quote or thing? You must have a lot.
I have a lot. One of the ones that's been addressed, two of them, I guess. One that drives me is let me think. I can go to Winston Churchill, or really, honestly, it's Albert Einstein from last century. One of his quotes that's attributed to him is that when he said, I'm sorry, my brain just got frozen. The tragedy of man is what dies. I was going to try to make it socially correct, but the tragedy of man is what dies inside of him as he lives. And for me, I've always looked at that and thought about that statement, meaning, and I say it when I tell it to people, is the tragedy of man is what dies inside of he and she as she lives. But, you know, when we're born and we're babies, we are open to the world. As a matter of fact, racism doesn't exist because as a child, as an infant, as a baby, until you're one or two or three, even 3 years old, if you didn't see or no one ever told you that there was a difference in color between you and another person, you would not even for 1 minute hesitate to raise your arms to a person of another color, especially if they're going to feed you. You wouldn't hesitate for a second to be hugged and held by somebody who's taking care of you based on anything other than the fact that you know they're nurturing. You would stop and back away from somebody who you think or might feel, you know, inherently that they're evil or they could be harmful or they've attempted to hurt you, but you're going to reach your arms up to everyone. But as we live, we start to believe the things that people tell us and start to shun away from other people just because of the way they look, whether they be about a different color, different shape, different size, different ethnicity, whatever. We start to believe those things that other people say, so our openness starts to die. When we're babies, you know, an infant knows better than anyone else that it can do anything because it'll try to do anything until it's proven wrong. Mm-hmm. You know what? That, as we get older, we're told, no, don't do this, no, don't do that, stay away from this. That openness starts to die. That idea that we are invincible starts to die. In some ways, it's protective and it's good, but other ways, that's what really thwarts, I think, you know, our ability to accept, you know, any obstacles or anything else that comes in front of us. So, you know, for me, I try to live, and living to me means keeping that thought alive that I can do anything, that I can be open to accepting or at least want to learn anything. And when you start looking at the world as an opportunity to learn every opportunity, every second of the day is a chance to learn, rather than that old saying of, make the place you're in the best place. No, what's that stupid old saying? You're in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Well, instead of being in the right place at the right time, you make every place you're in the right place every time you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being proactive rather than being reactive. And, you know, that's what I seek about. When I walk out this door, you know, it may sound ignorant and lofty, but guess what? I mean, you know, I'm in pain. That's one of the reasons why I think I may as well explain the way I deal with things. I am in pain 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. The way MS manifested in me is I have neuralgic pain in my lower extremities, in my side, and in my face. What I mean by pain, I'm not talking about a little throb or a little numbness. I'm talking about the fact that my neurons, my nervous system is sending signals back and forth to the brain trying to tell the other organ that, you know what, I hear you, and all that does for me is it turns my legs and my feet, my ankles and my toes into fire, and sometimes it's almost like, you know, you've got a hot poker stuck up between my toes, up to my shin. It hurts.
Mm-hmm.
I walk around this planet looking for positive things so I can keep myself out of the old woe is me and how bad I feel. And, get, you know, the residual for me is the fact that it helps to solidify my mood. It helps me deal with things. But when I walk out the door, I'm walking out the door, you know, as silly as it sounds, I'm walking out the door trying my damnedest to at least learn and grasp everything that happens, because there's going to come a day, supposedly, in this illness that I have, there may come a day where I may not be walking out the door too well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? While I have a chance to walk out that door, I'm going to walk out that door and appreciate every second. I'll give you another one. An example of this is, you know, Dostoevsky. I think when he was being held in prison, he talked about the times that the guards would take them outside and do this fictitious, execution process with them. And on one of the occasions when he took them outside and, you know, he stood them against the wall and they were counting down as if in 5 minutes they were going to be executed, he took the time and he looked across the field from him and looked down, and he realized that there was a really beautiful church over there. And he looked at that church for about a minute, and he realized how long that minute was.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciated looking at that church. And
sure.
4 minutes left, so he looked at something else, and he looked at a bird for a minute. Well, you know what? When you stop for a second and you just reflect and you take that time to take in all those things, it's so incredibly mood-changing, mood-altering. And, you know, you stop for a second and smell the roses. So when I say, you know, I didn't appreciate it along the way, that's part of what I try to do now almost every day.
little sad is that your quote, tragedy of man is what dies inside of him, and that's the problem with people. They have such negative opinion of themselves, and they're basically defeated sometimes before they even get out of bed, that every day a little bit more of their enthusiasm for life dies. And that's what I see with people, and that's a shame. Now, you take it one step further because that's an easy observation, but you're saying, hey, before you go to sleep, write down three affirmations, three good things about, you know, what went well today. It just could be that your sandwich tasted really good, or you let somebody, you know, pass you in the lane, and then the next day you start off with that. I think that exercise is wonderful, and people should do that, and they don't. They just think it's a waste of time, but quite frankly, you know it's not.
That, so there's a doctor, I think her name is Dr. Lubomirsky, you can look her up, who wrote this new whole theory on what's called the happiness formula. And what it basically is the fact that, you know, about 60% of how we feel is really either genetic or caused by our environment. And this is after having, you know, researched this and for years and years. As a matter of fact, this is now the cutting edge of the new way to treat depression and things. But what people have to realize is that if 60% of it is controlled by things that are out of your control, the other 40% is controlled by you individually. You can at any given time, and you can even do this as an exercise in your book. All people have to do is just for 1 second, for 5 minutes, take their fingers and put them in front of their mouth and hold those fingers in front of their mouth and look at it as if you were holding whatever is your favorite piece of fruit, your favorite piece of candy, your favorite thing to eat. I don't care if you're sitting there imagining that you're looking at a rib. If you right now held your fingers in front of your face and you look at your fingers and you look at it as if there was food there for you to eat and you think about that piece of food, you'll start to notice that in about 5 to 10 seconds, your mouth starts to salivate.
I got hungry.
So, well, that's telling you that you, with the power of your mind alone, can change yourself physically. You just made your mouth salivate, and you started feeling like you wanted to bite something, even though at that second while I'm talking about it, you weren't hungry. Well, if you can do that with your body physically, imagine if you take the time to actually think about the way you feel and go against the human nature, and that human nature is at least 6 to 7 of your thoughts, 60% of your thoughts every minute are negative because that's part of fight and flight, you know what I mean, because you're trying to be protecting yourself, so there's all this negative there. But if you consciously think about thinking about something positive, and you every now and then when you think, I don't feel good, you stop for a second, think about something positive, and you do that repetitively for a couple of times every couple of minutes, you can change the way you feel and you can change your mood and within a 10-minute period of time. If you were sad 10 minutes ago, I'll guarantee you if you put in at least 4 to 5 good, solid thoughts in a 5-minute period of time, take the time to do it, you can change the way you feel. And that's as easily as you did that by holding your fingers in front of your mouth. You can do that by sitting. What I do, when I'm really, because depression is one of, you know, the most pervasive symptoms of MS, is depression. You know, you can talk to anybody who's in this field, anybody who studies people who have MS. Depression is one of our biggest nemesis. Well, you can control that depression, not just through medication, but you can impact that depression by taking the time to positively think. And so that's what I try to do. And this is something that, you know, even in this point, when people are reading this and reading your synopsis and say to themselves, oh, you know, I can never be like them. No.
Right.
You should read this and stop and say, you know what, damn it, Montel's a human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jerry's a human being. You know, and I'm a human being, and they're no better than me, daggone it.
Correct.
Let me figure out why they're not better than me. I know they're not, and I'm going to own the definite. You know, if you do that, you say, it's crazy, but.
Yeah, you're right. That's why I'm picking people from all different walks of life. It's not just sports guys. It's all different walks of life, but not everybody's going to be able to relate to a 45-year-old white businessman. Some kid from the inner city, you know, because I speak to a lot of these children, and they cannot relate to that. But are they going to be able to relate to you? Yes. I have fighters. There's all different walks of life. And it's interesting because Stallone said the same thing as you. I said, why do you still do this? And he said, hey, listen, one day I'm not going to be able to do this. And until then, I'm going to do the best that I can. One day somebody's going to do a better job than me. One day I'm going to get too old. Until then, I'm exactly pretty much word for word. You obviously have a different motivation because of EMS, but the same type of common thread attitude. So,
you know, and it is achievable. This wasn't something I was born with. I believe this is something that I developed out of circumstance, and then I have made it a part of my being. And I don't believe that it takes, you had to do it from birth. I think that you can stop at any point along the way, and you can change your paradigm if you decide that you're going to do it. If you could decide and say to yourself, it can't be done, it'll never be done. But when you say to yourself, I can, I think that's, you know, that's the difference.
Okay, three just bits of advice. Inner city kid, 15 years old, got a lot going against him. You know, his mom's, single mom, maybe living with the grandparents, no money, you know, typical type of thing.
That's everybody else's situation. That's not who you are. If you own the definition of who you are, the definition of you is not child of a single mother living in an inner city and everybody else around me has a hard time. The definition of who you are is, my name is Brian, my name is Gregory. You know what? I'm 5'4", you know, I'm a really lean kid, I've been eating well, and you know what? When I take my time and I go to school and I'm looking at the classwork, it doesn't matter what my friends are doing. You know what? I understand that stuff pretty well. And guess what? I do pretty good in school. Why can't I define myself that way? That's where it's so important for an inner-city person or anybody, any young person, to understand what we mean when we say you have to own the definition of who you are. You don't wait until you're 35, 40 years old to do that. You got to do that when you're 9 and 10 years old. Do not define yourself by your circumstance. Define yourself by your ability and who you are.
You know, I'm so motivated by just you talking to me. I'm a black belt. I'm an instructor. I taught for several years. And I'm 50, basically 50 years old, and I'm in the cage now learning a new art. I never did jiu-jitsu as I grew up. And a lot of people around me saying, hey, you're 50 years old, what are you doing? And exactly what you're saying, I said, you know, 50 years old, that's just a number. That's not who I am. So exactly what you're saying, you can define it much better than I could ever do it. But I define myself not as a 50-year-old guy. I define myself as a guy who wants to continue to stay in shape and continue to learn. But a lot of people, like, hey, I'm 50, my life, they define themselves as a circumstance, and that's a beautiful thing that you're saying, because so many kids define themselves from their circumstances, and it's generally a negative circumstance, and you're saying, hey, don't get dragged down by that. That's not who you are. Focus in on your positive.
You have to. You have to, and you only get to do that when you take the time to know who you are. And even for the young kids that are in the neighborhood who, you know what, they have the pressure of the older kids trying to get them to sell drugs. They have the pressure of the other kids who say that you're being ignorant. You're trying to be, you know, like this, and you're not being true to who you are by trying to read or trying to talk right. No, 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 no. They're trying to define you by their definition of themselves. That's the difference. If you stop for a second and recognize that old silly, and I think it's one of the dumbest statements ever, but it can be so true. Misery loves company. It does. And most of the time, when a person outside of you tries to tell you what you're capable of, it's only because they've only seen their own limitations. How dare someone try to tell you that they know? Let me tell you, when I started this Montel Show, I swear to you, God's honest truth, I have witnesses to it. I went to stations around this country, and literally, we had a GM of a station in the city, and I won't say the city, look me and the sales representative from Viacom in the face and said, I'm sorry, guys, no bald-headed black man's going to work in this marketplace. It just ain't going to happen. And I'm sorry, we got to pass on the show. Now, 6 months later, that same person was kicking himself because he realized that the competitive station had my show.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I had...
Now, who originally said that to you? Producer or something?
That was a GM of a station. Literally, I was with the Viacom salesperson, and they didn't buy the show. And literally, you know, about a half a year later, the show went to a different station in the market, and we kicked his butt for a good 2-3 years before I changed over after he got fired, went to that back to that station.
Right.
So very, very interesting that, you know, even at that level, I still had to worry about, those kinds of feelings. But I couldn't believe them. But instead, we went ahead and marched forward and said, let's try to sell the show.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you one of the first African-Americans to have a show?
I am the first, I'm the first African-American male with a show in his own name that's run this long. Now, Flip Wilson had a show in his name.
Love Flip Wilson.
And but it wasn't a talk show. In daytime, I'm the longest running African American male to have his own show in the history of television.
And you're still not satisfied?
Nope.
What's your long term goal?
You know what? I got to tell you, I don't know where this ball stops bouncing. But I intend to bounce it until it can bounce no more. And so my long-time goal is to just be relevant, to just be a contributing member of the society, and I want to contribute at a level where, you know, it makes a difference. And I think, I know I can do that, you know, and that's my goal. So, I mean, I've really been on a mission to try to make people understand that they can own the definition of who they are. So when people hear, you know, I was for a little while when I got diagnosed with MS, I almost started trying my best to live down to the moniker of, you know, or live down to the doctor's expectation. And the doctors told me, you know, that number one, you know what, I was going to be in a wheelchair in 2 to 3 years. Well, that's a lie. Number two, you know, you read all the information about depression, and I started really believing it. I would go around, and, you know, I had a lot of friends would come up to me all the time. I'd tell, how are you doing? You feel okay? You've been handling your depression okay? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then I started realizing, wait a minute. Everybody just thinks I'm just walking around just a depressed fool, and yeah, depression does affect me. But guess what? That's not who I have to be. That's not the way I'm going to be. And if there are things that I can do to help mitigate and depression, I'm going to do it. And that's what I try my damnedest to do.